Continue our study of Genesis, and today we're looking at chapter 24 and part of 25, and a real transition. And I think, though on the surface maybe not as dramatic and a hinge event quite like something like Joseph revealing himself to his brothers or something, but I think it's one of the more dramatic events of the things that are recorded in Genesis. And this is just, I want you to keep this in mind. And I'm sure a lot of you are, what great literature this is. These accounts are just so intriguing. And this one today in chapter 24 definitely is the case. So glad that we're together. Jesse, would you lead us in a prayer as we start, please?
Our Father in heaven, thank you for this day we have to come and worship you. Lord, as we go throughout this study and later on our worship, we ask that we would bear your word in mind, help to be with the students and the teachers, help them to say and think in a manner well-pleasing to you. In Christ's name I pray. Amen. Amen.
So God's involvement in our lives are really at two levels. One is a miraculous involvement in what happens on earth in human life. But we need to understand that that is a rare thing biblically, and it didn't happen with everyone. A small minority encountered that, as well as we're given in the New Testament a time frame that those miracles were for that, would end in that first century period roughly. And so we would not expect direct miracles today. However, there's another way in which God is involved in people's lives, and that is in the everyday affairs and the unfolding of events and in what we commonly call providence, which is the idea of God knowing in advance and having a plan for things to work out a certain way in advance, and then guiding things to produce the outcomes. We'll talk about that idea a little bit in the sermon today, that does not make null and void human choice. And that is the perplexity that we have as a human being, that God is in control and His will be done, His plan will be enacted, but we humans have choices along the way. They don't cancel each other. They're both true. And keep that in mind in the book of Genesis, because we see a lot of choices that people are making, but we see that the dominant force at work in these events of the book of Genesis is the plan of God. And now, specifically after chapter 12, with this family of Abraham and his descendants. So, speaking of that family, this family is now going to start moving on past Abraham. So look here what happens. Abraham is aged, and look what is set up here. Daryl, can you read verses 1 to 9?
Now Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. But you shall go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac. And the servant said to him, suppose the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came? Then Abraham said to him, beware lest you take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there. So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter.
All right, thank you very much. When verse 1 says that in every way or in all things, God had blessed Abraham, what are some ways that he had up to this point? He's got all these flocks and herds and servants and all that. Yes.
The son.
The big one. What else? What about Abraham's status in Canaan?
He
He's preeminent. He's noteworthy. Okay? And so a lot of things have, after time, after a good while, things have really, well, God has done so much for Abraham. But there's one thing that Abraham wants to take care of before he dies. And that's what? Wife for Isaac. And what was his chief concern here about a wife for Isaac? Didn't want him from Canaan. Go back to where we came. Okay, we'll talk about that specifically in a moment. And he gives it to this head servant of his. Now, we're not told in this chapter who this is. We are told about the one who would be over Abraham's affairs if he died without a son, Eleazar, which is back earlier in the book of Genesis. Some people speculate that this is him. It might be, maybe not. We don't know. But this is somebody that he has confidence in. And for this to happen, Abraham's got to have help, probably because of his advanced age, for him to go back to Haran and work this deal out. Because this is going to be a deal to be worked out. This is going to be an arranged marriage. Now, we'll see a little aspect of arranged marriage as later on we see the bride's response to this. But this is going to be a negotiated thing. All right? So, he wants him to go back to Haran, back to where the ancestors are. We'll look at a map in just a moment. But why does he want him to go there? What are some things he's saying, Rick?
Well, and I think there's an implication here, but he doesn't want to take a wife from the Canaanites because of their heathenistic practices and ways. And apparently, you know, Abram came from a family that must have, at least in some ways, honored God.
Yeah,
God
that's a good way to put it.
Chosen.
Yeah, in some ways. That's a good way to put it, because we see evidence later in this chapter that the relatives that Abraham is referencing, and specifically, you know, Laban and Laban's father, they reference the Lord on several occasions. They know about God. Now, this is complicated because later on we see that Laban has household gods, okay? But, you know, so did the Israelites at a certain point. Still believed in God. So that's a problem. It's a big problem. But that's where it's at. And so, there somehow or another, I think it's related to exactly, first of all, what Rick's talking about, that this family had an awareness of God calling Abram or Abraham to the land of Canaan and God's involvement in this family's life. There's some connection there. So, and not only that, but this family would understand, because this is a unique family. This family would understand the uniqueness of the promises. So they would be on the same page. They wouldn't, you know, you ever, about this recently, you come into a new family and you're like, what do you mean you always have hamburgers on the 4th of July? My family always had hot dogs. See that kind of thing? So that's very trivial. But the idea that this family would have been aware of this history, that from Ur, Abram was called. They traveled with Terah, the father, up to Haran. Terah dies, and then Abraham, at some latter time, takes his wife Sarai and his nephew Lot, because Lot's father had died back in Ur, and they come down. They know the family history. They know how this thing's supposed to work. Okay? Yeah, Dave?
According to verse 7, the way I read it, God swore it would happen.
God swore what would happen? And that brings us to something. He swore what? That the descendants would have the land. Yeah. Okay.
As soon as I would give this land and send his angel for his son to take a wife there.
Okay. Okay. So, not take a wife from Canaan, but the promise was to have the land. Okay. Now that brings us to another point. What's the servant's concern? I think that factors in here. The servant was concerned if he goes to Haran and gets a wife, tries to get a wife, what's the problem? She may not want to come. And so, should I come back and get Isaac? What did Abraham have to say about that? No. You go get the wife and bring her back. And that's when he references the promise of God in verse 7. He doesn't want Isaac to do what? to leave Canaan. Why? According to verse 7. That's what he's been promised. Now again, there are thorny issues here. What happens to the descendants of Isaac? What happens to the descendants of Isaac in just a few decades? They have to leave and go to Egypt. Why?
Because of the famine.
Okay. So there's
ultimately to maintain the people and have them.
It does. Flourish,
really.
But we see that they leave the land later on, okay? But it's different circumstances. It's a famine. And it all works into God's plan. But somehow or another, Abraham is highly sensitive that Isaac not leave Canaan. And he ties it to verse 7. It's like they've said, it's that promise that this land is theirs. He doesn't want Isaac to leave because Isaac may not what? That's right, because if he finds a wife, he may not come back.
Well, look at Jacob. It took him 20 years to get back.
And exactly, with Jacob, yeah, but it was God's will for Jacob to come back, wasn't it? So they've got to stay close to that land because it was promised to them. So that's what's going on there. It's like this. Abraham doesn't want the events to reverse. I don't want the family going back from where we came. The family needs to stay here. We keep going forward here, okay? Because the land was promised to us. And at the end of verse 7, in light of this concern about the servant saying, what if the wife won't come? At the end of verse 7, Abraham indicates what? What confidence does Abraham have? The Lord will send an angel and help him. The Lord will work this out. And boy, does he. Okay? Anything else on verses 1 to 9? Okay, let's look at this servant's journey here. Joe, can you read verse 10 to verse 14, please?
Then the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. He made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. He said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please give me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camel also, may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master.
All right, thank you. I want you to get the picture here because there are a lot of mental scenes being painted for us in this chapter. Not unusual for Genesis, but this chapter is very vivid. The colors really jump out here in this narrative. We're told that it's not just this servant that's going, this Abraham's man or his servant. He's got a group with him. We're told in verse 32, verse 54, and verse 59 about his men. We've talked about this before, about servanthood in the ancient world. Sometimes a servant would have servants under them. So some three fellows on the store, then they hire a store manager who then hires people to work under him. It's that kind of thing. And so he's got servants under him. They've got how many camels?
10.
Remember what I said, camels were the common thing. If you're going to go long distance along the Fertile Crescent, camels were the common thing. We talked about that in a geography class recently. And besides the host of servants, 10 camels, and those camels are carrying what? All sorts of good things, all kinds of gifts. They've got a load on them, okay? You have to understand, in the ancient world, when you arranged a marriage, you had to do what? You had to pay up. That's right. You had to pay up. And so if he's taking 10 camels, he's taking plenty of money, so to speak. It's not money, but you got me. And of course, why would he have servants with him? Yeah. And remember Abraham, some of his men were like soldiers. Remember that? So this is a Brink's armored car kind of caravan. Really is. Because we'll see in a moment the gold will start flying off these camels. So this is an impressive retinue. That's a term we can use. This is an impressive caravan going up. Now, let's talk about this. We're told that they go to the city of Nahor. I think this is the first time the term Mesopotamia is used in the Old Testament, which is a term the Greeks came up with, which means land between two rivers, and those two rivers are the Tigris and Euphrates. This is that eastern part of the Tigris-Euphrates river valley of the Fertile Crescent. And so they, Abram's family had come from Ur, stopped in Haran where his father Terah died, and then he came on down with the rest of the family into Canaan. So he sends him back up here. This area is called different things at different times. This region is sometimes referred to as Padan Aram, and the people there is Arameans. Also, this city is called Haran, which is the name of the father of Lot, who died back in Ur, which tells us they probably named that city after the Abraham's fallen brother. But we're told here that it's called the city of Nahor, which is the other brother that survived. Now, maybe it means like the city of Nahor, as if that's where Nahor lives. Where do you live? Let's go to Ray Smith's town. You know, that kind of thing. It's not called Ray Smith Town, but it's just, we're referring to it that way. So that might be the reference. But this is all the same place, whether it's Padam Haram, whether it's Haran, or whether it's Nahor, it's all the same place. It's at the peak of the Fertile Crescent there, at the top of that arc there. So, now, how blind is this man on this mission? I mean, did he have an address? Did he have a phone number? He had a region, didn't he? That's all he had. I mean, there's a few of us in this room can remember what that's like, trying to find somebody's house without GPS, have you ever just gone to a neighborhood knocking on doors, looking for somebody? Now, there's not very many people who have done that anymore. But I've seen it done. I've sort of done it, okay? I used to work for my uncle who had a water softener business, and sometimes we go up some holler and in the mountains looking for somebody's house to service their filter, and we're like, is this the right house? You know, that kind of thing. Okay, so that he's going to have to just find this family. And back in the day, you could do that. You know, hey, where does Ken and Sandy Case live? You can go into a neighborhood. Everybody would know, oh, they live over there in that house. You know, this is... So people knew each other a lot more. And so that's what he's going to have to do. He's just going to have to feel his way along and find this family. So given that situation, what does he do as he enters this venture? He prays. How specific is his prayer? He's not like, Lord, help me in this. What does he do? I mean, I don't even want to go there on this prayer. I don't know what to make of this, because should we pray that way? I tend to think we shouldn't. It's almost like putting God to the test. You know, Lord, I'm looking, I need a new job. I'm losing my job. And so I'm just going to go online. And the first job that's listed, is that how we should work? Okay, see, that's just not realistic, is it? That's what he does. And it works. So I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm just saying I don't think it's an expectation we should have. That's my point. But he specifically prays, the woman that I asked for a drink of water, let that be from this family and be the wife for Isaac, kind of thing. And this starts several incidents where somebody meets a woman at the well in a very important way. We see that Jacob, when he travels up to this area, encounters Rachel at a well and finds out similarly, oh, this is Laban's family. We have Moses, where he encounters Reuel or Jethro's daughters at the well when he goes into the land of Midian. And then, of course, it's almost like it sets up John chapter 4 and Jesus and the Samaritan woman at the well. That there's some kind of encounter at the well And this leads to a very important step in God's plan. And that's what happens here. Here comes this maiden. Rachel, can you read verse 15 to 21, please?
And it came about before he had finished speaking that, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with a jar on her shoulder. And the girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please, let me drink a little water from your jar." And she said, Drink, my lord." And she quickly lowered the jar to her hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking." So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not.
Thank you. From a literary standpoint, I think that this is where the narrative has the most unique tension to it. He's prayed for the one that comes out with water. He asked for water, that's the one. And so, lo and behold, here comes this young, beautiful woman. And so, in the text, you're like, is this it or not? I mean, there's this tension here. And this narrative is driven, this whole chapter is driven really by speeches. Abraham's speech to his servant, the servant's prayer to God, his conversation with Rebecca, his conversation with her family, his speech to her family about what this is all about. And that's driving it, but it's peppered with strategic actions that are, well, these strategic actions are described with sticky detail, the way I would put it. For instance, she came with a water jar on her shoulder. You can just see that, can't you? Well, because he's prayed that the one that I ask for water will be the one. And lo and behold, it's not just a maiden that walks up. She's got a water jar. and she is an attractive maiden. He ran to her. Did you note that? She quickly let down her jar to give him a drink. She quickly emptied her jar into the trough for the camels. Okay? She ran to the well. There's a lot of movement here that's vividly depicted. And the one action that is not the most, it's the most subtle action is in verse 21. What does the man do in verse 21? He gazes at her. Yeah, Jess?
I think that verse shows that even he's a little surprised that this plan's going as well as it is. And may not be totally confident that this is still right, but is impressed by it.
Wait to see what happens here. Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting that even before he's finished praying, speaking, she shows up. It's immediate, yeah.
Yeah.
That's one thing we probably shouldn't expect.
Right. And so verse 21, especially, think about it. This servant doesn't have to wait very long for a wife for Isaac, but look how long Abraham and Sarah waited on Isaac. Just to show up. Forget about trying to figure out God in time. Just forget it.
He's going to do it when he does it.
There's also the fact that if they hadn't had to wait for so long for Isaac, Rebecca wouldn't have been around yet.
I'm sorry, the last thing you said?
If they hadn't waited so long for Isaac, Rebecca wouldn't have been around yet. God's timing kind of works out perfectly.
Yeah.
If he had, if Isaac had been born, you know,
oh, yeah,
way earlier, Rebecca would not have been around.
Right, he's 40, and she's a young maiden.
So, yeah, she'd have been a child. Wouldn't have been this one. Yeah. So it's just the timing's fascinating. But here he is. And I think this is verse 21. If this is a film, and it's not, it's meant to be words, so we have it in our minds. But the picture is all the movement stopped, running around getting water, and he's looking at her. Is this the one? Of course, the way you determine that is you ask a question. What's the question? This is the famous question in the South. In the North, the question is, what do you do? In the South, the question is, who are you? Who are your people? Who are your people? That's the question. So, her identity is revealed for us. Zachary, can you read verse 22 to 28, please?
When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing half a shekel and two bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels and said, "Please tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." She added, "We have plenty of both straw and fodder and room to spend the night." The man bowed his head and worshiped the Lord and said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness toward my master. As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsmen." Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things.
All right, thank you. I'll just say this. He's giving her the gold presents as a response to the watering. But a ring wearing a half shekel of gold and two bracelets wearing 10 shekels of gold, that doesn't equate to a few jars of water for a man and some men and some camels. This is an abundant gift here. And then he asks who she is. So let's look at this very simple chart. No problem understanding this, right? Well, every family tree is complex. But Terah is the father of Abram and his brothers. Haran died in Ur. That's Lot's son. And that's why Abraham is responsible to some extent for Lot. So Abram's brother is Nahor that stays in the upper Mesopotamian area. Thus the city of Nahor. He married Milcah and produced Bethuel. And by the way, Milcah was his niece. You see that? So, but also remember that Abram married his half-sister, Sarah, whose mother is unnamed, but it's a different mother, but their half-brother and sister produced Isaac. And so Bethuel had produced these two children that we know of that are listed, and that is Rebekah, who has shown up at the well and met the servant of Abraham. So Rebekah is the daughter of Bethuel, who's the son of Nahor that Milcah bore him. And so Rebekah is the great-granddaughter of Terah. Isaac is the grandson of Terah. So Isaac is the son of Rebekah's grandfather, which means, if you're keeping up with this, Isaac and Rebekah are first cousins once removed. You know how that works? Okay. So Isaac and Rebekah's father are first cousins. But Isaac and Rebekah then are cousins, but technically that's called first cousin once removed. Okay. They're cousins. Fairly close cousins too. They couldn't legally marry in America. But that happened back then. Okay, so that's who this is. Any question on who it is? So that's the descent there. This is Abram's brother's granddaughter. This is Abram's nephew's daughter. This is Isaac's cousin, technically first cousin once removed. Her father is Isaac's first cousin. Yes.
I just have one comment. The way the servant speaks here, you see Abraham's influence on him.
Yeah, you do.
This man has faith in the Lord and calls him, you know, by the right name. And
right. He's embraced the belief of Abraham regarding God's plan for this family and God's involvement in this family. And now he's an instrument of that, isn't he? And he's aware of that.
How much water do these vessels hold?
Oh, I don't get it. No idea. Enough for a young woman to carry. Several gallons.
Three or four gallons.
Yeah. I'll give you a guess. My guess is it's like a water cooler container. You know those plastic big things on a water cooler you flip over? It's probably something like that. I'd say young women back then could bear a whole lot more than young women today. I'd say young women back then could bear more than most young men could bear today. That'd be my opinion of that. It's just their lifestyle. Okay? So, she reveals, and how does the servant react when he learns who she is? What's the first thing he does? He worships God. He gives God credit for this. There's no, yeah, I did this. Look who I found. There's none of that. He gives God complete credit. Are we aware of what God gives us? And do we follow it with thanksgiving and worship? Do we do that? Or do we pray for something and then we get it and then it's like, oh, yeah, last month God gave me that. And then we think about it. This is his first reaction here. We'll talk about this servant in a moment. There's a lot to look at there. Matter of fact, he's the glue of the whole story in this chapter. So, Rebecca's family. Look at verse, Ken, can you read verse 29 to 33?
Rebecca had a brother whose name was Laban. Laban ran out toward the man to the spring. And as soon as he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's arms, and he heard the words of Rebecca, his sister, thus the man spoke to me. He went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. He said, "Come in, O blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside? For I have prepared the house and a place for the camels." So the man came to the house and unharnessed the camels and gave the straw and fodder to the camels. And there was water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. Then food was set before him to eat. But he said, "I will not eat until I have said what I have to say." He said, "Speak on."
Okay. So he's received by Rebecca's family. And I want you to look at who we're introduced to. The father, hang on here, things are not where they're supposed to be. Bethuel is the father. But it looks like Laban is like a real operative in all this, the brother. Because he's the one that meets them as they come to the house. And what is the first action of this brother Laban when he meets this man? What does it say? He runs to him, and what's the first thing we're told about Laban? What does Laban notice? The bling. And we would maybe just pass over that, right, Joe, unless we knew Laban. He was a conniver and a greedy person. That's how he proves himself to be later in the book of Genesis. And so we're not shocked that the first thing he sees is the gold.
I always assume Bethuel is dead because he's really not mentioned as being alive, is he?
Yeah, he's mentioned. Yeah, verse 24. No, I'm sorry. Listen, I'm sorry, people. I don't have my regular Bible with me. There's a good explanation. Zachary.
Verse 50 says that then
Laban and Bethuel. There it is. That's where I was looking. That's what I was looking for. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So, how's Abraham received by, I'm sorry, how's Abraham's servant received here? Joyfully. Oh, joy. They welcome him in joyfully. But before things get too far, what does the servant do in verse 33? He states his business. And so what we have starting in verse 34 onward is a pretty long speech. He updates them about Abraham and how God had blessed him, including the birth of Isaac through Sarah, who is the sister to Laban, and a rehearsing of his assignment to come find a wife, and all the events that had unfolded at the well, that he had prayed, and then Rebecca had come out with the water, and that this was the one, and all that. So he lays this whole story out, and then look at the response. Vince, read verse 49 to 51.
"So now, if you are going to deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me, and if not, let me know that I may turn to the right hand or the left." Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, "The matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken."
All right. So the servant is completely transparent. This is who I am. This is who sent me. This is the mission. This is what we're wanting. Okay. And what is Laban and Bethuel's response? We talked about this earlier. Their response reflects what when they hear the story? What's their understanding of it? This is the Lord. The Lord's made this happen. He's provided this. Which shows that they have this understanding of the Lord. Which goes back to our earlier discussion why probably Abraham wants a wife from this family. Okay? Not that it's a perfectly functioning family. We'll see that later on. So then, look what happens next. Verse 52 to 61. Rick, can you read that, please? 52 to 61.
And it came about when Abraham's servant heard their words that he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord. And the servant brought out articles of silver and articles of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. Then he and the men who were with him ate and drank and spent the night. When they arose in the morning, he said, "Send me away to my master." But her brother and her mother said, "Let the girl stay with us a few days, say 10. Afterwards, she may go." And he said to them, "Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master." And they said, "We will call the girl and consult her wishes." Then they called Rebekah and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go." Thus they sent away their sister Rebekah and her nurse with Abraham's servant, and his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, "May you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s. And may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them." Then Rebekah arose with her maids, and they mounted the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed.
All right, thank you. So I called this section, "There Goes the Bride." Okay, you can guess what the next section I called. But there she goes. Bride price. All these gifts come out. These gifts all come out and are given after the servant hears that the family accepts this. But before he even gives the gifts, what's the first thing that he does? Once again, because it's one thing to find her, but now he's got permission to take her. So what does he do? Yeah, and what does he do though? He worships God again. First thing he does when he hears the word from Laban and Bethuel, "This is the Lord's will," he worships God again. He's giving God credit for all this. And then he hands out the gifts. And this is the part where the tension now has been released. Will he find this girl? Okay. Who is this girl? Okay. Will her family let her go? Okay. And that's when the gifts come out and the food comes out and they spend the night. The tension's been released. Now it's gift time and food time. Now, what does the brother and the mother want? They've conceded to let her go, but what? Hang out 10 more days. And there seems to be a point about this, okay? But the servant doesn't want to wait. But this is how I would explain it. Uncle Charlie comes to visit. I can't know where I'm going with this. He's smiling. Uncle Charlie, he's with the family for a couple days. He takes everybody out for a steak dinner every night. He goes down and he buys toys for all the kids. He buys mom a new mixer for the kitchen. Uncle Charlie goes, "Yeah, I think I'm going to go home tomorrow." Oh, please don't go home, Uncle Charlie. See? I mean, the stuff was flying off these camels. And especially knowing what we know about Laban later on, again, Joe. He likes stuff. He's going to work to get what he can get. But this servant is adamant. Why? Think about this servant, all you've seen out of him. Why does he not want to delay? Okay, yeah, he is.
That's his mission.
This is one of the most mission-oriented men you'll find in the Bible. Joe, what do you want to say?
Well, I was going to say, Laban asked Jacob to hang out a little bit, and it ended up being 20.
Oh, look how that worked. Yes, great. Same M.O., wasn't it? Keep stringing it up. This servant, if I wait 10 more days, then they'll say, "How about another 10? Right? So this servant is going to accomplish this task. Yes?
Pretty obvious why Abraham chose him to be the one to go.
This is the man. Got to move on. We're out of time. So look at this here. Rebekah is called in and asked, "Will you go?" What does she do?
I will go.
She concedes. I want you to see that this was typical of how arranged marriages work. It still works that day in India, by the way. Usually, the bride or the bride and the groom have the right of refusal. When we think about arranged marriages, that's not always, no, you have to go marry him. In many cultures, the marriage was arranged, which means no courtship. That is, you know, directed by the couple. The parents put them together, supervise the courtship, and then they have the right of refusal. And so she doesn't refuse. She goes. I mean, come on. She knows a good deal when she sees it, though she's never seen Isaac. How you like that? So, let's talk about this man for a moment. What do you make of this servant? Somebody said a while ago, Ken, he's such a good selection on Abraham's part. What do you see in this man? He's got great faith in God, doesn't he? Completely dependent on God.
He has an enormous amount of love for his master.
He is loyal to Abraham. And thus Isaac. And now, Rebecca. He's a worshiper of God. He is so on task. Again, he is so mission-oriented. Nothing's going to deter him. And I tell you, he's the glue of this narrative. And he's not even named. We'll talk about this morning, about destiny. So many critical characters in the Bible, we don't even know their names. It doesn't matter in my life who knows my name. All that matters in my life is that God is in my life and using my life. And if I'm a nobody, that's okay. And he's the hero of the story in a way. He's got to pull this thing off. And he does it beautifully. So there goes the bride. Here comes the bride. Verse 62 says, now Isaac had come from going to Beer Lahoroi, for he was living in the Negev. Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, camels were coming. Rebekah lifted up her eyes when she saw Isaac. She dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, who is that man walking in the field to meet us? And the servant said, he is my master. Then she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Wow. I want you to see this retinue now. It's increased. You got 10 camels, you got the main servant, you got servants working for him. Now you got Rebekah. We're told that she takes her nurse, which is Deborah, and then we're also told that she has servants up to boot to that. I mean, this is a group coming up here. And looking at the timing of this, Isaac just happens to go out to have some think time. And he looks up, and here they come, okay? And you guys know what I'm talking about. There's nothing like seeing a good-looking woman pull up in a camel. Waiting all week to use that one. Then you may ask, where's Abraham? He's not mentioned in this text. Is he dead by this point? Well, we see his death mentioned in the next chapter, but things are not strictly chronological there. But Isaac is comforted concerning his mother's death. Nothing is said of Abraham. I think Abraham is alive. Here's the point of this. The focus now is being turned away from Abraham. Onto Isaac and the ones that would come from Isaac. And we don't have time to look at Abraham's death in chapter 25. And I'm going to hope Ray will take care of that, Ray Coney's, next week. All right, thank you all very much. Wasn't that a great account?